Okay, so topic at hand is it permitted or recommended to study other religions, other religious texts, and when? In halacha and hashkafa. So it actually is a precursor to this discussion. So obviously there are a lot of people who have and still do this. Like there are people who are familiar with all sorts of other religious texts. So the question, I'm not here to criticize anybody, obviously, and very big rabbanim have done it, so they had their reasons. The discussion is more what problems do they have to deal with in doing this, and what is their allowance of doing so based on? How do we source it in halachic and Talmudic sources? Like, why is it permitted, indeed? So but before we venture into that discussion, I would ask you, why would you say, like, hopefully we're comfortable with, you know, our Jewish religion, we have lots of Torah to learn, there's lots of Jewish texts to study, why would one go out and study other religions? And you get a reason. Curiosity. So that's an interesting point. Curiosity, the question is, as we say, curiosity killed the cat. Is that a kosher curiosity or not? But okay, just because you're curious, that's one. Anything else? Ah, very good, and that's like a... So I also got to that. Knowing how to respond to a heretic, as the Mishnah Pergeva says, is also a very worthwhile goal. And the other is, Ali, what do you think?
Maybe just to strengthen your own faith.
Strengthening your own faith. That by looking at other faiths and seeing the weaknesses in them, that can bolster a person's own emunah. So I believe that we do have examples for that in Halacha. So look at the first source. If the Rambam begins the Hilchos Avodah Zarah talking about Avram Avinu, right? So we know Avram Avinu grew up in Or Kasdim, and the Rambam talks about how he wasn't a ma'amin from a young age. He wasn't somebody who always believed in God. He came to discover God, and he grew up in an environment of Avodah Zarah idolatry. And in fact, his whole family served idolatry, and he served with them. And then, for the sake of time, let's go to the third line over here. Okay, actually, the fourth line. See that? V'yeda sheish malok echad. Eventually, after much speculation and thinking and argumentation, he realized there is one God, v'hu manig ha'gagol, and he is the one who directs the sphere, who bara hakol. And he created everything. And there is no God other than him. He realized the whole world was making a mistake. Right? What caused them to make this mistake was that they had began serving the stars and other images until they lost the truth. But the Rambam actually is referring to here is that people originally... The way Avodah Zarah started was as a medium of reaching God. Right? God created everything. People thought God created the stars. He created natural forces. And therefore, it's worth serving those natural forces also. We can serve the sun because God created the sun. But ultimately, what happens, they forget that the ultimate goal in doing that is reaching God. The stars become the gods themselves. Anyways, taking back to the Rambam, V'yada shakol ha'olam tohim, he realized that the whole world making a mistake. Came into Hikr V'yeda. Once he recognized this truth, he began to respond to the people of Or Kasdim and to engage in argumentation with them. So I ask you, if when Avram starts arguing with the people of Or Kasdim, do you think it's in spite of or because of his background in Avodah Zarah? I think it's a very valid point to say that it's not just that, well, Avram happened to have grown up as someone who worshipped Avodah Zarah in that environment, and therefore then he happened to also engage in this discussion with the people of his community. No, that's specifically because he was familiar with their philosophy, and he was familiar with what they did because he had grown up in that environment. That enabled him to then say, no, what you're doing doesn't make any sense. It's foolish. Because he knew about Avodah Zarah. Right? Similarly, we know Yisro, Moshe's father-in-law. It says, now I know that God is greater than all other gods. Meaning, Chazal say, he had served every single form of idol worship in his life. He experimented. He looked at all of them. And after going through that, he arrived at the conclusion that the Ribono Shalom is the greatest and truest God. The only true God. Now, obviously, we wouldn't advocate actually going about experimenting other religions. Right? That's not something that's clearly a Avodah Zarah. But one could argue that being familiar with such texts and seeing the problems with their arguments and their theology can then lead one to the truth that, yes, Judaism is the one true religion. Now, there are also going to be issues with that approach, which we'll also get to. Aside from that, I just brought through the first two and three quickly. I'll just say them outside. Number one, some texts from other religions can provide a lot of information about our own. So, for instance, if we look at source number two, Dr. Lauren Schiffman, who is a noted scholar on the Dead Sea Scrolls, generally very knowledgeable in terms of Jewish studies. So he argues that if you want a good historical source on the way Jews were acting at the time of the turn of the millennium, 2,000 years ago, right, before the Mishnah was written, the New Testament is an excellent source for that. Because the New Testament actually, it talks about the Jews of that time period and the different things that they were doing and their practices in terms of Tumah and Tara, different actions of purity, Netilas Yadayim. These are things that are not written about in Tanakh so explicitly. They're rabbinic inactions, but they're written very, very explicitly about in the New Testament. And it's actually a great source of Jewish history in terms of how halacha was kept 2,000 years ago. And furthermore, if you look at North source number three, I just found this fascinating. This is about Shuvah Archaim David Alevi. He's arguing for our unique historical connection to the land of Israel. And what does he use as some of his sources? He says, even according to the Muslims, who are clearly very affected by our presence in the land of Israel in a negative way, even they have to admit that the Jewish people have a historical connection to the land of Israel, and he brings proofs from the Quran. And he says, now I will quote to you, if you look at the end there, if you look at the English, source number three, we will cite several passages from the Quran confirming the fundamental right of the people of Israel to its country. Right, so he's using their own religious text to prove that we have the right to Eretz Israel. So clearly you can use and utilize the other religious texts in order to bolster your own belief and your own religious arguments. Nevertheless, we do have issues with involving oneself in other religious studies. So before we go on, what would you suggest? What might be a problem with doing this? Without us seeing any... So mentioning, okay, that's fair. Mentioning other gods, I guess I can avoid saying the. But that's actually not a bad point. Okay, that's a good point. Anything else? Simple one.
Something in the Quran that says the Muslims have a right to something, or we're doing something wrong, and then you're going to have to be bound by that because you know from the other stuff they say.
So it's a slippery slope. Essentially, it's difficult. You know, you'll say that you're only going to use it for positive purposes, but you know, there's always that possibility that a person.
Well, don't say that you're bound by it. You're just telling them you guys, by your own admission, are bound by it.
Right.
You're not using it for yourself.
Right. Right. So clearly, you can use it that way, but there's always that trap of, well, you know, maybe this isn't so bad after all. Right? There's always that trap. Maybe it will cause you to question your own beliefs. And that's not something to be taken lightly.
By studying it, isn't there some sort of small, almost acceptance of the Avodah Zarah if you're choosing to learn it and study it?
So I think it depends why you're studying it, which is obviously going to be a factor. Maybe part of this depends on intention, right? But beyond just what we might think is a problem with it, there are actual sources which seem to prohibit this, and at least the way the Rambam understood them. So just some background here. We have a few psukim that are quoted in this context. So you look at source number four. This is Parshas Kedoshim. The Torah says, Al tifnu el ha'elilim. You shall not turn toward idols, toward other gods. So, ambiguous, right? What does it mean to not turn to idols? Could have come up with a few interpretations. However, it does seem to be an expansion of a prohibition toward idol worship. It doesn't just say you can't serve Avodah Zarah, you can't even turn toward it. And the question is what exactly that means, and the Gemara does expand upon that. That's number one. And if you look at source number 5, in a similar vein, the Torah says, Yishamer lecha pen tinokesh achareihem. This is in the context of Hashem talking to Jewish people about when they enter the land of Israel, that they have to abolish all idolatry among them, and they can't tolerate idol worship. And then it says, be careful, lest you stumble after them, after they're destroyed before you, meaning after you go and conquer Israel, be careful. Why? Pendidrose loe hemle more, lest you seek out their God, saying, Echo yabdua gaime aela et loe hem, vese king amoni. Look at how these other nations are serving their gods. I should do the same. Now, different ways of interpreting that. Does that mean that we can't incorporate practices from other religions into our own religion? But one way of understanding this is, what is it saying? What do you think? What's going to happen if you look at the idol worshippers around you? Yeah, I should do the same thing. Right? And it's saying, be careful about being doresh l'Eloheim, seeking their gods, learning more about them. And I think this is it's significant, specifically because although it's one thing to say that, you know, there we should be careful about what we study because of the effect it will have on us, if that's just our own thinking. It's another thing the Torah says explicitly that you shouldn't do this lest you go and then adopt their beliefs.
Yeah, but who says Islam and Christianity is idol worship?
So that's a good point. That is a good point. We'll see that although that's a long discussion, particularly in the realm of Christianity, whether or not that constitutes idol worship, that's not really our topic. But even if it isn't, there is a problem, as Rambam will say, with studying or entertaining any thought that rejects a fundamental belief of our religion. So even if Christianity isn't idol worship, which is a discussion, nevertheless, whether the chosenness of the Jewish people or whether halacha continues to be binding or the authority of the oral law, all those are very important fundamental Jewish beliefs, which even if you'll argue they believe in a God in an appropriate way, but they don't believe in those things.
So then it's no longer clear-cut, though, that it necessarily falls under the biblical prohibition. At most, it might be the Rambam's interpretation of biblical prohibition, but it doesn't, like, on its own fall under the biblical prohibition.
Well, it depends how you interpret the biblical prohibition, right?
But it's not, like, clear-cut at this point.
Okay, so let's see how clear-cut it is, right? Okay, good. So, and just to point out, we look at source number 6. It's just simply quoting a pasuk that we say every single day. That one should not stray after their hearts and their eyes. What does that refer to? Any thoughts before I quote this next Gemara? What does it mean that you can't stray after your hearts and eyes?
Shmiras Sinayim
Brazara, not clear, right? So typically this is taken, I think, in the context of Shmiras Sinayim, meaning being careful about what you look at, particularly the Yetzer Hara of illicit relationships and such. And generally there are those Rishonim who describe it as not entertaining them, but literally contemplating doing an Avera. Like thinking about, oh, what would it be like if I did such and such an Avera? Oh, thinking about that hamburger or the cheeseburger at McDonald's, and it would taste so good. That's what it refers to. But if you look at the source 7 in the Gemara Brachot, it says, Achrei v'alchem zu minut. What does it mean to not stray after your hearts? It refers to minut. What's minut?
Heresy.
Heresy. That we're not, you know, has one stray after their heart. It's not talking about anything that you're seeing. It means thinking about heretical thoughts. Similarly, Gemara, your name, please?
Baruch Wise.
Baruch. So Baruch has made the point, well, how do we interpret these psukim? It's sort of ambiguous. But the Gemara, the Gemara number 1, already said that this specific prohibition of Lo Sasuru does indeed refer to investigating heresy. If you look at the Gemara in Sanhedrin, we have another Chazal, meaning once it's Chazal, then they're telling us how to interpret the psukim. It's Torah Sheval Peh, Rabbi Kiva Omer. Right? Rabbi Kiva says that in the list of people who do not merit a portion in the world to come, you know, we don't want to be in that list. It's a pretty bad list. Try to avoid it at all costs. So there are some really bad things in there, some people who deny Torah and Hashemayim, things of that nature. And then it says, somebody who reads external books. What are external books? It says here, Besifrei Minim. Refers to books of heresy. A person who reads books of heresy, again, we can think about why you're reading them or what the context of this prohibition is, but it says here, a person who reads books of heresy does not merit a portion in the world to come. Again, very dangerous territory. Finally, in relation specifically to Al Tifnu El Ha'ililim, if you look at source number 9, this is Gemara in Shabbat, it says as follows. Tana Rabbanan. Writing that is under an image or under idolatry, really, other graven images, is prohibited to read on Shabbat. So this is referring to nothing. This particular prohibition doesn't refer to Avodah Zarah. Just there are certain types of reading that you can't do on Shabbat. It has to relate to Shtar Hadyotot, business contracts. The Chazal were afraid that if you read them, aside from generally being not Shabbos material, where there's also a concern that you might come to write after reading a certain text. So that's the Gemara saying. You can't read these captions under certain images. It falls under the rabbinic prohibition of Shtar Yotos. V'diyukna atzma, but to look at the image of an idol itself, ach b'chol asur l'stak ilba, even during the week is prohibited. It's not a Shabbos prohibition, it's a general prohibition. Mishum Shinemar Al Tifnu El Ha'ilim. It says, do not turn toward idols. So here, at this point, the Gemara is at least prohibiting looking at an idol. Looking. Okay? Now that doesn't necessarily extend to learning about idolatry, but then you take the next source, depends how you interpret it. My Talmud Amr Bechanin Al Tifnu Kel Midaat Chen. El Ilim is Kel Midaat Chen. Do not turn toward a god from your knowledge. So there are actually different ways of interpreting this. If you look at I brought you the translation from Sefaria, quotes the Aruch, who says, it means do not push God out of your mind. Meaning it sounds like more of a practical time consideration concern. You should be thinking about God. Don't push God out of your mind and think about other gods. Right? Your concentration should be on the Ribono Shel Olam. However, Rashi says that the Kel Midat Chem is a god conjured up from your own mind. You shouldn't be thinking about fake gods. So we see that the Talmud, in terms of Lo Sasuru and in terms of Al Tifnu El Ha'ilim, extends them to me a prohibition against approaching heresy and Avodah Zarah. So this brings us to the Rambam. Now, the Rambam is the main source who is very discouraging of studying these type of texts. Take a look at source base. I mean, source number 10, this is from Hilchos Avodah Zarah and the Rambam, the Laws of Idolatry.
In terms of just the Gemara's interpretation, all it leaves you with is heresy, but that still begs the question of the parameters of heresy.
What is heresy?
Yeah, meaning it's not very illuminating, what the Gemara says.
That's true. That's true. What is Minot? So, the Rambam does talk about Minot in a lot of places. At the very least, any alternative conception of God would constitute a heresy.
Based on the definition, the Gemara just says heresy.
What could heresy mean if not denying? Well, at least includes. Well, it means something, right? And if it means anything, it means not believing in God, right? That would certainly fall under heresy. We could argue about which type of things are heresy. I'm not denying that's a legitimate discussion. But if a person says, I don't believe in God, that is the most fundamental belief we have, that certainly would be heresy. And by the way, it's what? Yeah. Mahadri. Your yotz is on. Yeah. Baruch Hashem. You could get a hechsher on your heresy. Which leads to the discussion of reading books which promote atheism is sort of relevant to this. But we have to define when and how and why you're doing it. So if you take a look at the Rambam, he says as follows. This is source number 10. Svarim rabim chibru ovdi kochavim ba'avodasa. Let's pay very careful attention to what it is that he's forbidding and what the situations in which he forbids it. So he says, the idol worshippers compose many books regarding how to serve Avodah Zarah. Heich ikra avodata. What is the main way of serving it? Ma ma'aseh mishatea. What are the laws and practices involved with it? Tzivanu HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God commanded us, right? This is God. When God commands something, then probably should listen. Shelo likro bo'otan asfarim klal, not to read those books at all. Velo naharba, we shouldn't think about it. Velo b'davar midvarea, and not to discuss it in any way. Va'afilu listakel b'dmut atzura asur. And now he's quoting the Gemara in source number 9. Even to look at the image of an idol is forbidden. Shenemar al tifnu el ha'ilim. You cannot turn toward idols. Meaning, although one could have said, well, looking is different. That's a real physical interaction with Avodah Zarah. The Rambam is seeing that as an extension of a general prohibition with studying Avodah Zarah. And regarding this, it says, lest you seek out their gods, saying, how are they serving their gods? As we quoted earlier, what does that mean? You shouldn't ask, well, how is it that they serve their gods? What do they do when they go into their temples? What kind of sacrifices do they bring? What kind of music do they listen to? You shouldn't ask those questions. Even if you personally have no intention to serve it, why? Because doing such will cause you to turn toward it and to imitate their behavior. Because as the pasuk says, and I should do the same. So I'm saying that asking, well, how do they serve Avodah Zarah, causes you to want to imitate them, and that is certainly something that we want to avoid at all costs. Okay? Yeah. Yeah.
How does the idea that we lost the Yetzer Hara to do Avodah Zarah play into this?
How does the idea that we lost the... I would think that... You're saying that if you lost the opportunity of Avodah Zarah, so then you shouldn't be worried. Yeah. Shouldn't be worried. That is a good question. I remember discussing this with Rabbi Torchiner one time. He actually asked me this on the way back from something, giving a shiur about this. I think number one, I think the type of Avodah Zarah there, the Yetzer Hara that's being referred to, is something different, meaning it doesn't mean that no one will ever entertain thoughts of heresy. I think what that means is that talks about the Yetzer Hara. Let's say you talk about Yetzer Hara toward a certain forbidden food. That's not like an intellectual entertainment. It's that, like, I want it. It's like an emotional attachment. Like, it feels good. It's a physical experience. I get the impression that that's the type of Yetzer Hara they're talking about. Like, they really wanted it. That it felt good to worship these gods, that there was a temptation. As opposed to the intellectual inquiry that when you're faced with a strong argument which undermines your beliefs, being unable to answer such an argument will naturally lead you to, you know, question your religion. That's not necessarily the same type of Avodah Zarah. So I think that's one way of saying it, that it's still not the same intensity as it was. I think that's what I mentioned at the time, that the type of Avodah Zarah there, you know, one there, you know, a temptation to bow down to a statue is different than curiosity about, let's say, the religions that we have nowadays. So you might nowadays be curious about the questions that we deal with, which are more kfira, like, can we really prove that there is a God in the world, or can we really prove that the Torah is from Mishmael Shemayim? I think that's the type of Avodah Zarah they were dealing with in those days. Does that answer your question?
Is that Avodah Zarah, though?
Last two things I said?
Yeah.
I would argue that that's probably kfira, not Avodah Zarah. Right. And that's the next thing the Rambam gets to. In case you're worried, he talks about that too. So if you look at the Rambam as far as Gimel, so first he summarizes the first thing. All these prohibitions are one idea. It means do not turn toward idolatry. Just an interesting note. He says anybody who turns toward idolatry in a way that they perform an action is actually liable for malchus, for lashes. Which is interesting. So the background here, and think about it in contrast to velo sasuru in a second, the background here is that generally one doesn't receive corporal punishment for an inactive violation, for something that you don't do or something that you just violate through your thought. Generally, you don't get punished for such a thing. For let's say, if you think about the mitzvah, I don't get punished for not saying Shema, right? Or I don't get punished if I bought chametz before Pesach and I didn't get rid of it, I just kept it in my possession, I just did nothing. I don't get punished for violating bat lo yered lo yimatzei. I don't get punished for possessing chametz on Pesach. In order to get punished, I needed to do an action. So the Rambam says that if I go and buy chametz on Pesach, then I do get lashes, right? So what's interesting here is the Rambam is saying that this prohibition of turning toward idolatry, al tifnu el yalim, although one might have thought, what kind of prohibition is it? Primarily, does it involve a physical action? What would you have said? No. What kind of prohibition is it?
Thinking.
A cognitive prohibition, right? Nevertheless, he says there is a way that you can get lashes if you end up performing an action. Contrast that with the next halach in the Rambam. He says, v'lo avodah kochavim bilvav. This is at the bottom of the source 10. We are not only referring to idolatry. Ella, who sha'asu lefon acharei ma'ashava. That is not the only thing that you cannot turn toward or orient yourself toward in thought. Ella kol ma'ashava shu gorim lo la'adam. La'akor ikar mi'kerei ha'torah. Any thought which causes a person to uproot one of the principles of the Torah. Muzharin anu shalo la'alota alibenu velo nasiach tatin l'kach. We are commanded not to bring that thought up upon our hearts and not to allow our minds to think in that way, which will then cause us to be pulled after the thoughts of our heart. A person's, and this is important to keep in mind, why is this? Because a person's mindset is limited. Ram says we sometimes overestimate how advanced we are intellectually, and we think we can handle anything, and we can assimilate any idea into our way of thinking. So it's not always true. You don't always understand things appropriately. Not everybody can appreciate and understand the complete truth. If a person just follows the thoughts of their heart, he will destroy the world with his limited knowledge. And then the Rambam quotes, maybe you're one time you'll think, well, maybe there's no creator. Many times you'll think, maybe there's no Torah from heaven. If you just follow these thoughts that sort of arise in your mind and your heart, that can really cause very destructive thinking. And here he says, V'al inyon zeh hizirat torav ner marba, v'lo tatsur achorel v'alchem v'achrein echem asher atem zonim. It says, you shall not stray after your hearts and your eyes. Klomar. Lo, and here pay special attention. Lo yimashe kolecha mehem achar da toak tzara. You shouldn't be pulled after your limited mental capacity. V'yinne and think shemach shavato maseget ha'emet. Think that through your thought process you have arrived at the truth. Kacham ruchachamim, so said the sages. Achrei levalchem, after your heart, zuminut, that refers to heresy. V'achrei nechem, zuzinut, and after your eyes refers to illicit sexual relationships. V'lav zeh afa pishu gorem adam atodor me'olam, and he says, even though this type of thinking, this prohibition, will cause somebody, min olam haba, will cause somebody to be, to lose their portion in the world to come, in bo malkut, it doesn't have the punishment of lashes. So it's interesting. Contrasting, if you take a look at these two Rambams, and you contrast Lo Sasuru and Al Tifnu El Ha'ilim, what would you say the differences are between those two?
It sounds like one, the first one is like just, it's the prohibition of like, it's almost like a sniff of the Yisoy, what is that?
Correct.
The second one almost even sounds somewhat almost Dubanan even, like it's almost like the Pesuk in the Smachta, because the Perish Chachamim Al Zen.
Okay, so Prishu Chachamim Mazeh, I'm not sure is the Rabbanon, that might just be Torah Shebaal Peh.
Could be, but it just sounds like less
okay.
In the Pesukim and more just like, it almost sounds like it's more based on the reason is that you'll just end up thinking bad things, which will lead you to do things, as opposed to it itself being that bad.
Well, that might be his explanation.
It almost sounds like, even though he says in the end, in the first mitzvah, it says, the reason is you'll end up worshipping, it sounds like more to just an independent, just a thinking about
okay.
it.
Okay, thinking. What do you make of the fact that for Al Tifnu you can get lashes, but for Velosa Suru you cannot?
One would be Durban and one would be Durait.
Ah, okay. That's one. Well, if they're both Durait, so how would you explain that? What do you think?
I mean, we don't have thought police.
Correct. What about Al Tifnu though? Why do you get lashes for orientation toward Avodah Zarah? So out, yeah.
I thought you have to actually bow down to get that one.
Well, you do, but. Couldn't you theoretically perform an action while, you know, entertaining Kfira also? Like, what if I go buy a book about, you know, the latest book of new atheism? No, I go and buy it.
It's still about Kavana. You could buy books on atheism, but if your Kavana is, you know, if you want
right.
to think of an intelligent rebuttal or
right.
see the folly need or restrain your own beliefs, like, who cares?
Right, right,
like,
right.
There's not necessarily a powerful way to start bowing down to Baal.
I hear that. So, okay, we'll think about that. So, a few points I want to make here. First of all, just in terms of the nature of these prohibitions, it would seem to me that Al Tifnu Le'ilim, as you said, a Sif Avodah Zarah, is not specifically to thought or action or thinking or looking, right? The fact that you can't look at Avodah Zarah, it seems to be a general requirement to avoid any connection with Avodah Zarah. That's what it means. Don't turn to. It's a very general prohibition. It means don't look at it, don't think about it, don't study it, don't interact with it. Meaning it's a general prohibition. There are different ways you can do that, but they all constitute turning toward, orienting yourself toward Avodah Zarah. Whereas in this, the Lo Sasuru seems to specifically be thought-oriented. That the Torah is telling you don't think in a way that will cause you to uproot one of the fundamental principles of Jewish belief. But it's thought-oriented. It's the thinking that the Torah is prohibiting. And what type of thinking is it? So on the one end, when I first look at the Rambam, you think it means you really can't think. However, what he ends up saying is, you can't jump to conclusions. Right? Meaning, it's that just because you hear some lecture by, I don't know, Richard Dawkins about whatever, you know, how religion is foolish, what you can't do is then come to a conclusion, oh, I agree, and the belief in God is wrong. That's Chas v'Shalom such a thing.
Doesn't
it
just mean you can't even think about it because you may come to a conclusion? That's like,
so, I you can't klomar lo yimashich, that from the beginning, I agree with you. But then he says, first of all, he says, "Lo nasiat datenu l'kach." We shouldn't allow our minds to get lost. When you're talking about hesech hadai, that usually means sort of not thinking about something. And here it means just don't let your mind wander endlessly. Meaning, is it really conceivable to allow to prohibit somebody from even thinking in a certain way? People think, like, thoughts sort of come up in your mind. Like, you walk by a church and you think, okay, like, you have a thought. It doesn't seem possible that the Rambam would prohibit you from having a thought pop up in your mind. It seems more likely what he's saying is don't then allow your mind to drift and consider and contemplate. Number two, I think when he says, "Lo, what shouldn't you do? Lo yimashay kolecha mechem achar daito v'yedameh shemachashavto maseged ha'emet." Don't think that you've achieved the truth through your thinking. Don't jump to the conclusion and say, okay, this is what I think, this is what's right. And then try to, you know, either adapt your Torah philosophy into that or reject it. And I think that's what we do sometimes. Sometimes, you know, we sort of accept, you know, whichever doctor atheist is talking and they're right because that's science. And then we try to fit Torah into that as opposed to thinking about it, you know, and analyzing and saying, hey, they're making some good points, and which points are, you know, fact, which are their theory, which are informed by whatever philosophy or beliefs they have, and how does that, and how, let me compare that to what Judaism actually thinks. Right? It's different. He's arguing, don't jump to the conclusion. Okay. Just remember, if you look at source 11, you're without... so the Michal Sinuch is, it actually puts up brings up an interesting point, which is that there's a discussion generally, if I have a prohibition, a law, which could involve an action or could not, does that result in lashes? Is that considered a law sheyesh bo maaseh? Again, you need a prohibition, an active prohibition, in order to be liable for punishment. So what if there's a prohibition that could involve an action but also could not? So one class example, the Rambam actually takes a side on this, is I'll even give you two conflicting examples. So the law, the prohibition against jealousy, lo tachmod. So the Rambam says you only violate lo tachmod if you do an action, right? If you go, so if I'm jealous of Natan's poppy, which I kind of am because I didn't bring my poppy today. So I'm jealous of Natan's poppy. So if I just think about, I wish I had a poppy like that, that would be spectacular. That's not lo tachmod, or at least that's not the full-fledged lo tachmod. If I then go and say, hey, Natan, can I have your poppy? And he's like, no. And I'm like, what if I pay you for it? He says, no. And I say, I'm going to pay you $2 for it. And I keep badgering him about it. And eventually he's like, okay, take the poppy. That's lo tachmod. However, says the Rambam, I don't get lashes for that. Because it's a lav she'en bo maaseh. It's a prohibition which doesn't involve an action. Now contrast that where the Rambam says you're not allowed to, as the Torah says, you're not allowed to possess chametz on Pesach, right? You can't own chametz. You have to get rid of it. So we sell our chametz or we revatel it. However, he says, if you buy chametz on Pesach, you get lashes. So this is a difficult topic in the Rambam. So the Michal Sinuch here has his take on, he says, well, it could be that in the case of Al Tifnu, even though, you know, what he says is there are elements of Al Tifnu which don't require an action, but he says Al Tifnu as a whole does require some sort of action, which is sort of interesting. But in terms of the way I would say it is, the question in each of these cases is the prohibition fundamentally a thought or inactive prohibition, and then whatever actions you do are sort of, you know, preparatory or situational. You didn't have to, do any action. You just happened to have done that in the circumstance, and therefore we're saying the action isn't part of the prohibition. It's just sort of coincidental. Whereas if the action is a fundamental part of the prohibition, in the case of Al Tifnu, I would argue, it's not just that you happen to have, let's say, gone and, as we'll see, let's say you go into a place of Avodah Zarah and you buy one or something like that. It's not just that you happen to have done that. The buying itself is a form of the prohibition. It's not just thought. It's any orientation toward Avodah Zarah. Okay, that being aside, so what we've seen until now is the general, we talked about some of the benefits of doing this. However, we've noted that there are psukim which point in the direction that it's a problem. And the Rambam does indeed elucidate that problem, although I think you can point to a certain type of study the Rambam is talking about, a study that will lead you to make wrong conclusions, a study that will cause you to question the fundamentals of belief. So what I want to do next is, number one, is quickly point out, if you look at source 12, beginning source 12, that there are those Rishonim who understood at least Al Tifnu El Halilim differently. So look at source number 12. Says the Rambam says that, what does Al Tifnu El Halilim mean? Yomar shelo yifne libo be'alilim lahamin sheyia behem to'eles. You shouldn't turn toward idolatry to believe that it is beneficial. Oshiavo asidos asher yisnavu mehem. Or to think that the predictions that emanate from people who worship Avodah Zarah, when someone says, you know, I heard the name of Baal, that so-and-so was going to happen, you shouldn't think that it's actually going to happen. Meaning, how does the Rabban interpret Al Tifnu El Halilim? Not that you shouldn't study, learn about these books at all, but that you shouldn't think that they are true, legitimate. That you should believe that he elaborates, that the only being that interprets or dictates what will happen in the world is Ribbono Shel Olam. So it's essentially just not giving legitimacy to them. Doesn't mean you can't study them necessarily.
Does that mean legitimacy whatsoever? Because can there be a difference between saying they're the truth versus that they contain a sliver of truth?
Well, what do you mean? What type of truth do you mean? I think that's the question.
So let's say like Greek mythologies, right? Like everyone recognizes that there are like fundamental like, character. other conceptions and archetypes of people that like you, that are conveyed in like Greek mythology. And there are still some people who give wine libations to Zeus and still take them like literally. But most people, like, they read Greek mythologies, they see them as like illuminating on the human condition. And there's like an element of truth there, but
right.
No one actually believes that like the world is being held up by some tyrannical, very temperamental Greek gods.
Right. So I think what you're saying is that, I mean, you know, we know Yesh Chachma Bagayim Tamin, that if there is wisdom amongst the nations of the world, you're supposed to believe that. I think what you're pointing to is that there might be works which contain Avodah Zarah in them, but also contain other ideas that are not particularly relevant to the idol worship per se, but, you know, are illuminating in terms of how they inform the way we think.
But they're still within the idol worshiping paradigm. They're still within
right.
the corpus of information that's idol worshiping in its nature. I mean, the fundamental premises of the Greek mythologies are that you have a bunch of different
right.
gods.
Right. I hear you saying. I think what you're pointing to is it's a pretty fine line. If something is true, I think we accept it as true. The question is, you have to figure out whether it's actually true and whether the idea that you're thinking about is contingent upon a fundamentally flawed understanding about a very important belief that you can't accept.
In a way, like, it's many years, it always is one or the other. Like, you have to just totally reject it outright. I'm saying, like, why can't you just reject the false parts?
Maybe you can. And the truth is, once you're quoting it, I had to not brought it here, but the Gemara, when we get to the exceptions, The Gemara talks about Rav Meir, who was a student of Acher. Acher of Lishma ben Avuya, who became a heretic. He rejected religion, and he became a kofar, and he started violating it specifically. There was a whole discussion and story about how he like specifically violated Shabbos. And he was leaving the Tchum, he was leaving the border of the city, which you can't do on Shabbos. And he told Rav Meir, stop there, I'm going to go. So it says that asked how Rav Meir learned from Acher, and it says he took a fruit, he took out the good part and threw away the bad part. And the Gemara says, how could you do that? Well, Rav Meir was a gadol, he was a talmid gadol, he was a great student. So there is that paradigm in Chazal of taking the good and leaving the rest. The question is how it fits with. Okay, so that's a good question. So let's hear Moshe. That's a good question. Good question. Okay, so either way, I'm just pointing out here that the Ramban learns differently. Look at the Ram and Sefer Mitzvot Katan. They again really limit this idea of Al Tifnu. Your Ram gives examples of actual physical interaction with the idolatry, hugging it, kissing it, washing it, putting shoes on it. Then he's just looking at it. These are all, it's not just learning, you know, Greek mythology, let's say. It's like going to a statue of Zeus and like polishing it. That's different. And the Sefer Mitzvot Katan says, what does it mean, don't turn to idols? Don't look at them. It means don't look at them. Don't look at idols. Not the same as studying the books. So what exceptions do we have? So as all of you, I'm sure, are thinking, people have done this throughout history, and there has to be a way, number one, to combat external attacks, and number two, a reason how they could have done such a thing. So if you look at source number 15, this was quoted before. Mom, your name, please? I'm sorry. What is it? Mordechai quoted before. It says Mishnah Parkei Avot, "Vada ma shetashiv le'apikoros." You have to know the way to answer a heretic. And the Magen Avot explicitly says that this Mishnah informs the way we think about the prohibition against reading books of heresy. Right? He says this is why we study these disciplines. And it's not included in the prohibition of reading Sfarim Chitzonim, reading Sifrei Minor, reading books of heresy. That we have to know how to respond to people who launch polemical attacks against our religion. And one way to know that is to contradict them from their very own texts and say, no, you even don't think that based on your sources. Again, this is a particular dispensation. It means in terms of responding to attacks. Look at source number 17 and 18 for a second. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin here says, "Hechi avid hachi." So this is referring to actually Rabbi Gamliel and Kishuf. So you know there was a general prohibition against witchcraft and using black magic to bring things into the world and things of that nature. But Gemara talks about how Rabbi Gamliel used to produce plants, kishuim, through black magic. So the question is like, well, how do you do that? That seems to be a pretty blatant violation of practicing black magic. Don't we say that person who actually does this is liable? Islam made shiny. No, to teach oneself is different. The Amar Mar Lo Tilmud La Sot. You should not learn to do. La Sos Yatalamed. You shouldn't learn to do, to perform the abominations of the nations around you. Avatalamed La Vin Lehorot. You can learn about them in order to instruct others. To instruct others what not to do. And while this applies to Kisha specifically, the Meiri extends this to not just witchcraft and sorcery, but to Sifrei Minot, Sefram Rechitonim as well. Rekiva Omer, Afa Korei Besfram Rechitonim. Rekiva says you should not read these external books. Ratza Lomar, Shalo, Lahavinu Lahoro, Eladal Elech Be'emunatan. He says, that doesn't mean, what does that mean you shouldn't read these books? When it's not talking about when you're doing it to understand and to instruct. Rather, you're doing it in order to follow their belief system. So the Meiri, again, is building in this dispensation, which is discussed explicitly in Sanhedrin about Kishuf, into the prohibition against reading books of heresy. And furthermore, the Gemara in Sanhedrin talks about how judges need to be familiar with Kishuf. Why? Because if you want to judge somebody for violating, let's say, witchcraft, or you want to judge somebody for serving an idol in the way that it's normally served, what do you have to know? How the idol is normally served. How else are you going to know about it? So we do have these exceptions in the Gemara. They are more, on the one hand, they are more direct, and they're pointed toward a particular goal. It's responding to attacks from without. It's in order to understand and judge a case properly, or to instruct students appropriately. But nevertheless, you do have these exceptions. So one big problem that does come up from this discussion is the Rambam himself. So on the one hand, the Rambam was the one who formulated this prohibition, right? Who took the Gemara and the Psukim and said, you cannot study heretical works or works of idolatry. However, big problem number one is the Rambam did just that. In fact, he writes one of the Rambam's biggest ideas in Morna Vuchim is that many of the mitzvot that we have are directed toward disproving the belief and philosophy of the idolatry at the time. And he says, I read a number of these works of idolatry, and books ascribed to Aristotle and other books of the time, and he says, and based on that, I now understand why the Torah commanded us to do X, Y, and Z. It's clearly there to make sure you don't believe in these other ideas, right? And the Rambam often says, well, the reason we have this mitzvah, we don't eat basar v'chalav, because at that time, people who worship avodah zarah would eat basar v'chalav, and that's why we don't do it. So the Rambam very clearly did read these works, and he read Aristotle, who, you know, although does serve as the source of many of the Rambam's own beliefs, still Aristotle rejected Kadmos, the idea that Hashem was Kadmon. He thought the world's always been here, right? Aristotle certainly held certain heretical beliefs. So how can the Rambam pass in this way and then go against exactly what he said himself? Number two, the problem is that the Rambam doesn't codify these exceptions in Mishnah Torah. It would be one thing if the Rambam did this, but he also said, well, there are exceptions, like L'Havin L'Horot, Damash HaShavah B'Koras, but the Rambam doesn't even quote them. He does, however, quote the idea in Sanhedrin that the judges had to be familiar with Kishuf and Havleh Vorozara and the like. So in terms of the Rambam, as you would expect, some Rishonim say that he was a gadol, he was great, and the Rambam knew all Torah Shebechsav and Torah Shebal Peh. And so that doesn't mean that we can learn from the Rambam. He felt, you know, he had reached the point where he wouldn't entertain these philosophical beliefs to the point where it would shake his own emunah. There are those that point out that the Rambam was responding to a particular need at the time. It's Damash Tashla Pikoros. that there were people who were struggling with these questions of philosophy. And if you look at the Moreh Nevuchim, people were bothered by how can the Torah describe God in a physical way. And he's responding to a need that existed in his time. And that's why it was permitted for him to do so. Ferris Yisrael actually on the Mishnah, which says that you can't look at Svarim Chitzon, you can't look at external works or books of heresy. He says that means in a set way, in a sort of, you know, every day you set aside a certain amount of time to study it. But he says, but to do so in order to respond to heretics is good, and even I would recommend doing it in the bathroom, you know, so while I have spare time. So I don't know. It tells you what the Ferris Yisrael is obviously very committed to utilizing all of his time.
What if that's the issue to read books of heresy in the washroom? Because then you're going to be set thinking about the proper beliefs as opposed to.
Be careful.
The,
yeah.
The proper beliefs in this proof.
I hear you. I hear you. Apparently, he wasn't bothered by that. I don't know. I got to know yourself. So, the Rambam is difficult. There are those. It's one thing to justify what he did, and I think that's understandable. Why he doesn't quote these heterim is also problematic. If you look at the Divrei Yirmiyahu, I believe it was him. He says that he doesn't understand really the Rambam, and although you can explain him, it's difficult. Maybe the Rambam didn't want this widespread dispensation to, you know, do it for particular reasons because he was afraid about the effect that it would have on people who weren't really ready for it. It's also noted that, yeah, so the question is practically, what's our approach, right? We had the prohibition, we had these problems associated with it, and we have these exceptions. So typically, and I'm sure, you know, a university student who is involved with courses that often do discuss ideas which are heretical, and some are valuable and some are very difficult and damaging, potentially, how does Shimon proceed? So, Rav Yehuda Parnas actually asked this question to Rav Moshe. He asked specifically the Meiri, who takes this idea, this heter, of Lohavina Lohorot, to instruct and understand, and Kishuf, is he correct in extending that to Avodah Zarah, and practically, are you allowed to study these works? And Rosh says as follows. He says, number one, B'davar mash hevi ha-me'iri chalak chelak ha-krib b'svar mechitzonim shalavna ha-rot lek iser shuwa din ha-sipe Avodah Zarah hu emet. That which Me'iri says that there is no problem of reading external books, it indeed does extend to books of Avodah Zarah if you're doing it for the right purposes. Ein makom lechalek ben sifrei kfirah sifrei Avodah Zarah kol masurim. Meaning, books of heresy and books of Avodah Zarah are equally prohibited. They're both a problem. Whether the book discusses an idol or it discusses, you know, atheism or the fact that the world always existed or the fact that Torah is not Mishmaim, those are equally generally prohibited and therefore permissible when they are permissible. He says maybe the Rambam gets this from the idea that judges need to know and be familiar with Avodah Zarah so that they can properly adjudicate cases of Avodah Zarah. And he says, don't tell them they just watch people studying Avodah Zarah. The only way for them to know was for to study it. However, he says, take a look at the bold. This dispensation and leniency should only permit those who are the greatest Torah scholars and Yirei Shemayim generation. Not normal people. Says Al Kapanim. He says, if you have a book that says, well, back in the day, they used to do this ridiculous thing, and this is how they worshipped it, but it's clear from the writing itself that it's absurd, and that's okay for sure. And he says, even a course, it's taught in that way, is okay. And I think there's two questions here. In terms of the permissibility and this prohibition, yes, there are exceptions. It's not a black and white prohibition. It depends on why you're doing it. It depends on your goal. But even if you feel that the prohibition isn't, you know, necessarily applicable to your situation, the person has to know themselves. You have to know how strong your beliefs are. You have to know how susceptible you are to being convinced or shaken from other philosophies and such. And beyond even that, Rav Lichtenstein writes how it's very difficult to be passionate about various things. And we have a passion for this type of study, and we get very involved in learning about whatever it is, whether it's Greek mythology or Christianity or the, you know, the new atheism. it's hard to then be as equally passionate about Judaism. It's hard to really divide and conquer in that way. And so I think that although there is room for leniency and it could be beneficial and there are people who have done it and we shouldn't question them, a person has to know themselves how it will affect them religiously. And ultimately, everything that we do should only be in the with the intention of advancing our Avodat Hashem and our belief in Emunah and Torah, and not the other way. We should always have the ability to assimilate all the different things that we learn into our Torah personalities and continue to advance in our Emunah. Thank you very much.